Male and female represent the two sides of the great radical dualism, but, in fact, they are perpetually passing into one another. Fluid hardens to solid, solid rushes to fluid. There is no wholly masculine man, no purely feminine woman.
Welcome to Lady Fiction's episode number 5. Today we take on a foundational text of American feminism, Margaret Fuller's Woman in the 19th Century from 1845, from which you just heard the opening lines. This text has been on my wish list from the very beginning of this podcast, and here to tackle it with me, Stephanie Schaefer, is my guest, Andrew Wildermuth. Andrew is from Annapolis, Maryland, in the United States. This spring, he received an MA in North American Studies from the University of Erlangen-Nuremberg, and this fall, he will begin a PhD in American Studies at the University of Jena as a member of the research group Romanticism as a Model, Modell Romantik. His research focuses include poetry, new materialisms, and the politics of Romanticism. He's also a poet himself and has poems published in the Columbia Journal, Eco Theo Review, and Colt Brown Review. And he has 2 critical articles forthcoming on Claude McKay's Harlem Shadows and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So thank you for being here today, Andrew. So Andrew, can you maybe contextualize Margaret Fuller for us a little bit for the listeners who are not an American studies nerd and not so familiar with her? Who was she and what is her eminence?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me again, Steffi. It's a real pleasure to discuss this very challenging text. First of all, I'll start by saying I'm by no means an expert on Fuller's biography. So if there are experts on Fuller out here listening, forgive me in advance. but she was born in 1810 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she was the daughter of a pretty well off lawyer, not super rich, not pretty like upper middle class intellectual family, and he was later a U.S. representative. They were a strong Republican family, not the Republican Party that we think of today, but as in like actual Republican governmental ideas. So she was born to this very educated father, and he raised her with like particularly aggressive education and very strict. Which she, if people are interested in reading some more about it, in a fragment called Autobiographical Romance, she goes more into depth on the effect of her schooling on her, and so which she actually blamed for lifelong migraines of being from too young of an age stimulated by philosophy, by ancient studies, by language studies, and all this. So she had this kind of unique place. And then in the instead of going to Harvard, because she was not allowed, because she was a woman, she was a teacher, and she led very important groups that she called her circles. And so they met. They had these women's groups that would meet in Boston, and they would discuss philosophy and literature and religion, and sometimes guys came, sometimes not, this was a very important part of her life and of her story, and then she becomes a journalist in New York City, and did that for a number of years. She was one of the editors for the Tribune, and then she went to Europe and was a war correspondent during the Roman Revolution, after touring through continental Europe and the United Kingdom. And she there had like very, she changed a lot as a person and her politics changed a lot. She was married to a soldier in the Roman Revolutionary Army, out of wedlock, had a baby, which was her total no-no throughout a lot of her own writing previous to that. And then on her ship ride home from Italy to the United States, her first time home in several years, with her now husband, Ossoli, and their couple-year-old child, she died in a shipwreck a couple hundred meters from the shore of Coney Island. Mm-hmm. It was like a pretty much a huge tragedy for people in the area. Then Thoreau comes down and searches the beach for her manuscript on the history of the Roman Revolution. And unfortunately, it was not found, but some of her things were found. And That's kind of her story.
And in American studies, she's routinely called one of the transcendentalists or the only woman transcendentalist, but it's kind of a joke also that, you can't talk about Fuller without talking about the transcendentalists. So we'll try to, to navigate that and read her in her own right and not just as a representative of the, what many have called problematically so, the first independent generation of American literati after independence. I think also there's her work is being re-edited or maybe forthcoming new editions of her complete.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's pretty strangely, it's like kind of hard to get your hands on like an excellent collection of Margaret Fuller's complete works. So there are a couple of projects right now that I think in the next few years we should have really excellent definitive collections of Fuller's work in contemporary context. And so that's pretty exciting. So I think it's an interesting time to be reading Fuller, to be thinking about Fuller, to be teaching Fuller. And I think that, as we'll talk about in this podcast, I think there are some really interesting moments in which she's kind of anticipating some of her own thinking and also challenging it. And I think that we find a lot of some troubling aspects of her text, which I hope we get to be able to discuss and challenge in the podcast.
And let's start a little bit by talking about what kind of text is Woman in the 19th century and why you selected the opening quote.
And as you said, what kind of text is this? And I think that's really maybe one of the most central questions and thing about this book is it very much escapes, I think, easy description and easy analysis. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fundamental part of its politics too, and what it's doing for the women's movement or for generally in the context of 19th century U.S. politics. Mm. So I think that's a great place to start.
So what about the opening quote? It's fluid. Gender categories are fluid. That was one of the surprising elements in this text for me.
Definitely. I think for a contemporary reader, I think sometimes we have a cultural or era-based arrogance in thinking that we have created everything, that we are, that things are totally unique from our own political vantage point. Because we talk about fluidity of gender a lot. I think we think of that as being very cutting edge. It's very interesting that she uses that metaphor here of fluidity and the passing of states. And I think she separates here masculinity from man and femininity from women, and at least that they're not essentially bound, and that there is this necessarily this necessary passing into one another, as she puts. To me, that is one of the most striking things of the text, and I think it in some ways is very similar and also departs a lot from the ways that we read gender today. So I think that part of the text's challenge is distilled a lot in this excerpt here that I've read.
Yeah. So it's to me it was intriguing. I've been looking forward to read this text for a long time, and I didn't read it as a student, nor did I read it in my academic work since I was a student. But in American studies, it seems that this text is often overlooked. And as a teacher of American studies, I would maybe also confess that I might shy away from teaching it because it is so complex. But it's important to observe that this is a foundational text in American feminism. It's published in 1845, 3 years before the Seneca Falls Convention, which sees the publication of the text that people usually talk about when they talk about the beginnings of American feminism, namely the Declaration of Sentiments. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the authors of the Declaration of Sentiments, quotes women in the 19th century as a model or as an inspiration for her. So the beginning of the women's movement in the United States is intricately tied to this text by Margaret Fuller, Woman in the 19th Century, which comes as a kind of an edit on an article that she wrote earlier, and where she talks about it. This was originally a journal article. And she says, people got back to me and I have to kind of spell out what I'm trying to say once more, because apparently I didn't say it very well in the first place. And then she spells it out in 100 pages and calls it Woman in the 19th Century. And it's 100 pages of appeal, of quoting other texts that she goes back to, of talking about the state of literature, of philosophy, all in one interest, namely to say, we need to start working towards greater gender equality. And that's why I think the quote that you picked for the opening is so intriguing, because that's not what you would expect from this kind of text. I mean, Cady Stanton and the women's rights movements, what they do in the Declaration of Sentiments is they basically parrot the Declaration of Independence of the United States and just touch it up a tad here and there and say that other than the British tyrant, from which the American colonists are breaking away and declaring themselves independent with the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the new tyrant in the Declaration of Sentiments is man. So it's not a British king. Now it's man who is a tyrant to woman in marriage. And the Declaration of Sentiments uses this kind of manifesto-like declaration style to say, this tyranny has to end, just like America became independent from Britain. Now woman has to become independent from man. And Margaret Fuller has a similar agenda, but she does it so differently when it comes to form. So she starts off by saying, I need to rephrase my argument. I need to retrace my steps. And, you know, you listeners, you're going to hear us leafing through the text a lot, because that's what you have to do when you deal with this text.
Yeah.
But she states her agenda throughout in various quotes. And if it's okay with you, Andrew, I'm just going to go to some of the quotes and read them out to you. Because it is a declarative text that comes back to declarations over and over again. So this, the agenda setting, what women want, what is important. It is not the transient breath of poetic incense that women want. Each can receive that from a lover. It is not lifelong sway. It is not money. It is that for which at once includes these and precludes them. It is for that which is the birthright of every being capable to receive it. The freedom, the religious, the intelligent freedom of the universe to use its means, to learn its secrets, as far as nature has enabled them, with God alone for their guide and their judge. So women want freedom. There's the freedom word. Then this is a little before where she talks about the signs of the times. We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down. We would have every path laid open to woman as freely as to man. Were this done and a slight temporary fermentation allowed to subside, we should see crystallizations more pure and of more various beauty. We believe the divine energy would pervade nature to a degree unknown in the history of former ages, and that no discordant collision, but a ravishing harmony of the spheres would ensue. So it's basically saying, okay, we want freedom, but we don't want to kill all the men or, you know, abolish men on earth, which is what often, you know, those who are fearful of feminism say that women want. This is a call for saying, let's make this even better. She says over and over that women have been overlooked, that their potential hasn't been used, that it is time for women to realize their freedom, and then the project of mankind can get better. And this is the third part where she maps her agenda and she looks into the future and tells us what is important to her. So whether much or little has been done or will be done, whether women will add to the talent of narration, the power of systematizing, whether they will carve marble as well as draw and paint is not important, but that it should be acknowledged that they have intellect which needs developing, that they should not be considered complete if beings of affection and habit alone, that's important. So Fuller really tells us we have a lot of work to do because we have overlooked and we have allowed women to become this childish partner in marriage and this unequal part in the union of man and wife that she talks about so much. And she says that's what we need to do. And she does this from a vantage point that is particularly American also. It's not only about the humanist project in general. It's also about being an American and having this responsibility because you're part of that visionary project that is the United States in the 1840s. Andrew, what do you think? How American is this text?
So I think that for me, a fundamental part of her philosophical and maybe religious and political projects here is definitely rooted to the continent of the United States and this kind of this mythologized idea and racialized idea of the conquest westward across the American continent. And I think that from our perspective today, I think there is some pretty clear criticism of that. But I think that her text here also kind of fights against itself on that. And I think that it's, but she does, I think, absolutely take part in the idea of exceptionalism and the idea that the United States is this melting pot place where European philosophy, idealism, and civilization, as she says, kind of really gets put to test and becomes some practicable thing in this kind of like cosmic evolution even. And so I think that in that way it's interesting. I think she has this like this grand trajectory of the universe that necessarily goes through the United States. And I'm kind of reminded too of, I mean, I think there's a long tradition of this. I'm thinking also of Martin Luther King's quote of, this is not the exact wording, but something along the lines of the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And so I think that there is this universal cosmic aspect that she brings very closely into material contemporary politics of the United States. And that to me is really fascinating how she does that here, and also problematic in a lot of ways. And I think as contemporary readers of this, there's a lot to deal with, both in that it is this early sort of revolutionary, radical feminist text, but also is totally inseparable and totally a part of this kind of settler colonialist American project and American exceptionalism.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, on the one hand, there's a cosmic arc that you talk about. So it's time for seeing this beyond territories or developments. And then on the other hand, it's very much rooted in a rhetoric of nationalism that she goes back to again and again. And she does this also cleverly by, on the one hand, saying, there have always been in history, and this is capital H history, of course, that readers will be familiar with as canonized history. So she says there have been women leaders, Elizabeth of England, the first Queen Elizabeth, Isabella of Spain. So she says there have been women that have been trailblazers and that have shown us that women don't have to be relegated to the sidelines, that they can take responsibility, have power, and this and this. She talks about the classics, about Sappho and Eurydice and other figures from classical myth. But then again, she goes to say, this is an age of nations. And she says, in the nation state, names like victory is female, religion is female. And there's a point when she says, Isabella of Spain was the one who sent off and financed Columbus, who then discovered America, which we know today is one of the grand myths of origin stories of the United States, which has been contested and is very critical, as you said before. But the Columbus narrative she uses to relegate to Isabella, who is the architect of the Columbus mission. And she says, it's time for us Americans to repay Isabella's jewels. So she really says the so-called discovery of America is due to the entrepreneurial explorative, you know, efforts of Isabella of Spain, who was a woman leader in her own right. And we have to repay her. It's our task today to vindicate the fact that women have been on the sidelines for so long. And towards the end of the text, and here you hear me leafing through it again, she says, it's time for the superhero woman to appear. So, and will she not soon appear? The woman who shall vindicate their birthright for all women, who shall teach them what to claim and how to use what they obtain. Shall not her name be for her era Victoria, and this is the Victorian age, for her country and life Virginia? Yet, and then she says, predictions are rash. She herself must teach us to give her the fitting name. So she really says, okay, we're at the threshold moment in the 1840s in the US. She says, it is time. I see signs over and over again. And those signs are the media that she quotes in the opening. So that's how she frames her argument. She says, you know, things are happening. It's really weird. We don't have a name to put on this thing, but there are tendencies that are developing. So a woman must advance to allow mankind to advance. There's newspaper coverage that she quotes. She also quotes abolitionism. This is what I want to talk about as well, coupled with women's rights and women abolitionists. And this is the key starting point for the Declaration of Sentiments, because Elizabeth Cady Stanton and other women abolitionists went to London to the World Abolition Conference in the 1840s, and they were relegated to the galleries because women were not supposed to have any political opinion. And that's when they came back, gathered at Seneca Falls, and wrote the Declaration of Sentiments. So the abolitionist movement and the institution of slavery in the United States are also a backdrop from which she draws her argument. And she says, if we can't make this, she couples it and melts it together. And says, if we can't get this right, then the hope that is tied to the American, to the US experiment is lost. So it's very much an argument that draws from the logic of nation states in the 19th century and says, we need to get this right and we need to help women realize their potential. And if we can't get this right, then, you know, no nation shall ever stand after us.
Yeah, and that's one really interesting thing, I think, about her project here, or projects, is that it's not just about woman herself, or about women plural, but about a natural flow of social realms and of cosmic mm-hmm. realms, and even like among the stars. I mean, and I really think that it's not just metaphorical for her, you know, and I think that's where this text is profoundly transcendentalist, mm-hmm. is that it really is like that these political ethical questions are real material parts of cosmos and of natural systems. And so I think what's interesting though is that she's not saying it's just for women or for woman, woman in the kind of Platonic singular sense, but that it is for the kind of like harmony of all mm-hmm. things. That woman's development, woman's balancing is like going to balance the energies of the United States, of the American continent, and of the world and cosmos at large. It's kind of how I kind of read this. So here, for instance, she says also pretty much toward the end of the text, says, by being more a soul, she will not be less woman, for nature is perfected mm-hmm. through spirit. So there's this sense of shedding off, and this is so American transcendentalist, of shedding off like the corruption of civilization. Mm-hmm. And I think this is this kind of American myth of like the European civilized stuff is shed off, and here on this like great naked continent can the universal soul really reveal itself, herself, himself, and kind of shine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that I think is very interesting in context of material context of settler colonialism and the US project is that it's really they are these very fundamentally connected movements. I think these soul and cosmic and national movements. So I find that totally perplexing in this text and really utterly challenging. Yeah. And as you said earlier that you and maybe other Americanists shy away from it in some ways, I think this is one of the reasons. I think is that also her association with Swedenborg, Swedenborg, where I mean, someone, it's like, I think in order to really read Fuller, I mean, it's a very mystical text. Yeah. And so I think you need so many toolkits. Yeah. You need like mythology, you need mysticism, you need romanticism, you need feminism and gender studies and all these things. It seems like almost an impossible text to read.
Maybe that's a good way for me to include a nice quote from Poe, which I found, where he talks about, this is a contemporary review. He said, "Woman in the 19th Century is a book which few women in the country could have written, and no woman in the country would have published, with the exception of Miss Fuller." So this is a nice way of saying, okay, not only is she a genius in and of herself, she's also a literary woman. She knows how to, she has the independence and the means to just do it and get this text out there. And then I think what you're talking about when you're talking about the perplexities of the text and the complexities of the reading experience, that you need so many archives and so many cross-references to decode it properly, is of course that she can do it in this way. And she does. She's totally the author. She is totally, you know, she does not have to pay any dues to anyone. She goes to the sources that she finds intriguing. And these include Swedenborg, a whole lot of German romantic thought, a whole lot of Goethe and Schiller. She taught herself, you've told me this, she taught herself German in only 3 months as a teenager. So she's clearly an impressive figure who is modeling also herself after the universal genius that was Goethe. I mean, she's really, and that's the gesture, the key gesture of the text. This is not literary criticism or myth criticism or, you know, talk about the electricity of women, which we have to talk about in a little bit.
Absolutely.
It's not the one thing. She jumps back and forth all the time. I mean, once you're reading about Iphigenia of Tauris, and then in the next session you read about the German ballads, and then you read about Isabella of Spain. Mm-hmm. So she can, because,
and she's switching between genres, like she's going from prose to then these like little she has these like dramatic excerpts, you know, where it's like the enslaver like talking with the feminist, and then it's like man generally, this like platonic form man talking to platonic form woman, and then it's like a poem of Fuller's, and then philosophical abstraction, and then like a translated poem from Schiller, or it's like, it's really, and that it's totally unannounced.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's difficult to teach it, but I will teach it at some point. I'm determined to do it. I'll have maybe an army of Germanists and philosophers to help me with that, but maybe collaborative teaching.
Do you think that could be read as queer also in this like kind of like...
In this avant queer, avant la lettre meaning? One thing, the queerness, she does, and she's very, I think, deliberate about picking her sources and asserting her authorship and going off the beaten track. Mm-hmm. So she does that. That's also, I think, though, a strategy for the transcendentalists. I mean, it's not, they're also trying to do something new with new forms. So you could read her as one part of the group, or maybe as a badass part of that group. The other reading would be to say she's vying for the Universalgelehrte, for the Weltgeist in the sense of Goethe in the German Romantics. And this is also the threshold moment, which I find so key. So in doing that, she's also saying, okay, we know these different things, and when we read them all together and put them onto the question of a woman in the 19th century and maybe woman in the US, then it really becomes clear what a future trajectory would be. So that might be a model that she draws on. But then again, I think it's interesting to read her as a queer author figure, because, and that's one of the things that I came across, she also uses the Miranda figure from Shakespeare's The Tempest. She says, I spoke with Miranda, constructing Miranda as a figure whom she talked to, but she herself is also a Miranda figure, trained by a father who let her read and do everything that she wanted to find out, but tried to also kind of shield her from the world. So Miranda, in the logic of The Tempest, is this figure who is unverbildet, in the terms of she's not subjected to the concepts of the world from the outside. She's on the island. And the Miranda figure as an author figure might also be a way to describe the strategy that she uses to build her text in queering the given lines, in turning maybe also to the body. That's, maybe we could talk about the body as well. That's the thing that, so you talked about the cosmic before and the spiritual, but the body components are very much there also in the opening that you quoted for us, in that de-essentializing logic of there are no two separate spheres, there are no two separate genders or sexes. Yeah. They intermingle and intermix. That's one perspective she has.
Yeah, so there's kind of like the flesh and also like the spirit that imbibes the flesh. Mm. And I think that in that way, I've wondered if this could be read in this text as what we think of as sex and gender also. Like if that's almost her kind of spiritual mystic go at like, yeah, of there being women being like physical sex. And then gender maybe being what she would call woman and man, right? Or a femininity and masculinity. And so she sees it as these spheres that are in every person diversely manifest. And so I think that in that way, she does say that there are like, you know, people with different bodies. And then there are some, you know, where she says, at one point she says, I think that like one third, you know, if we lived in this ideal world, she says, like one third of basically like gendered male people or like, yeah, people of like male sex and one third people of female sex would pursue careers and lifestyles that are like of the other gender.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why she also talks about girls wanting to play outside
and the epic line of let them be sea captains, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. She doesn't. She's certainly against prescription, and she's certainly against what Simone de Beauvoir a little later talked about when she talked about nurture. So that's an interesting thought. That's the one thing. So she says the gender lines are not as prescribed and as rigid as you would think. But then again, she has this whole part about women's essence, women's electricity, women's genius that you know, intersects with this in interesting ways, and maybe also does it a little bit. So she says, women's genius is electrical in movement, intuitive in function, and spiritual in tendency. And the critics, I started looking into this a little more deeply, because she comes back to this notion of women being electric, women being more prone to mental illness. And this actually is a connection to 19th century mesmerism. And I read an intriguing article by Rachel Blumenthal, which is called Fuller's Medical Transcendentalism, which basically argues that women in the 19th century advances a materialist technology of feminine self-making. So she... Basically, what the critics have said about Fuller with this electricity question is that it's sexual essentialism, that women are so different from men that, you know, they can never, the two can never be compared or meet. But Blumenthal says this is not about sexual essentialism and not about the transcendence of sexual difference for unification. But women are more prone to intellect. So it's a definition of a female genius that stands aside and maybe above the male in this sense. So this electricity, this nervousness is maybe what also led to discourses of hysteria and of paternalistic pathologizing of women in the 19th century with Mary Todd Lincoln, for instance. This for Fuller in her day connected to mesmerism and the idea of a soul being magnetic, something being there that is not physical, it can't be touched. I mean, that's the beginning of psychoanalysis, really, in the 19th century. This is a trend in her day, and she uses this to declare women's genius as something apart because women are more electric than men. And she says that men have basically done very poorly by women and not developed this electricity part. And that's what needs to be done. And that's when the quote I used in the opening about when this is achieved, she says, nature will be more crystallized. The world will be better. Mm-hmm. So it's not just human society or, you know, there will be more equality among humans. It's about the universe. And this brings us back
and that
to
way,
this.
It reminds me.
Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of like hippie discourse, you know,
she's not only a queer, a hippie before her time.
I think of contemporary, like new age hippie kind of stuff. I mean, she literally says crystallization, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. It was like there's this sense. And this is tied also, I think, with myth, that there's this proximity of woman to the earth and to natural forces and to the stars, and that like life. And I think this is basically mystical, is that there's this, like, it seems like the most ideal politics and ethical politics is one that is like a fine tuning of like universal currents. And that, as I've said already, I think it's very transcendentalist, but particularly the way that she does it, I think, is this like, yeah, it's like, I feel like I can almost smell the sage burning as she's writing something like that. I think.
Which brings us back to the logic of the form.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, and it brings us back to the logic of form and aesthetic experience of the text. Because when you read it, I mean, you can smell the sage. I'm like, I can smell the dust of book pages that she has around her of all the canonized and not canonized, or all the different works that she draws so geniusly on or ingenuously on. Mm-hmm. And there's a breath and a rhythm to this, despite the fact that you get thrown into a different genre or a different kind of text every now and then. It never stops surprising. So it's not a read where you can say, oh, I'll read another chapter or I'll read another page. So you sit down and you either put it down right away or you keep reading and you're like, okay. So now we're in the midst of, I don't know, the French Revolution, and then we go somewhere else.
Yeah.
It was really also a tour de force that takes you on.
Yes.
and that's where I think...
It's kind of like a maze.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, she's clearly the genius leading you through. She has these episodes where she comes back to saying, okay, this is what I want. This is what I'm fighting for. This is what I want to say. For me, this was such a threshold text. you know, it's viewed from the year 2021, when we've seen waves of feminism, if you want to read feminism in waves, or if you want to read commentaries on feminism as a white invention that, you know, sidelined others for a long time, or intersectional criticism of white feminism. We have such an intriguing vantage point to go back to this particular text, because it navigates many of the questions that I have today as a female identified person in this world. So on the one hand, she navigates difference. So she says women are electric, and we have to make sure that they can realize their electric potential. But then she also says women have been treated as children. So we have the childhood discourse in marriage. So she has a lot of stuff to say about marriage, when it's good, when it's not good, how men are comfortable in marriage because they want to render women childish partners in marriage. So she comments on that social component. She has something to say about class, which is an update from the original article she wrote and published first. So in this Woman of the 19th Century, the longer version, she also talks about high-class ladies, American ladies, being preoccupied only with their looks. And she says, come on, women, forget about, stop counting your conquests, stop being so vain. And she says that in lower-class women, she finds more realism, or she connects more easily to them. This is, it shines through every now and then. It's not in your face, but it's there. So she addresses this. And then she says, in the history of literature and philosophy and all the texts that she reads, there's a reflection on the idea of woman that comes back over and over again. So she says it's something that people have been thinking about a lot. And this is this essentializing component where she says women are different. So she does say women are different. And she says basically women are better also. Sometimes. Sorry for that. But does she? Would you agree that she says women are the better men, or the better humans?
Yeah. So she says, like, here on the same page where you last quoted from. So yeah, that we have the special genius of women, I believe, to be electrical movement, intuitive function, spiritual, and tendency. So that's like 1, 2, and 3. Electrical, intuitive, spiritual. And then she says in the next paragraph here, more native is to her to be the living model of the artist than to set apart from herself any one form in objective reality. More native to inspire and receive the poem than to create it. So I think there's this kind of, I mean, you could almost think of that also as like the male's this more phallic creature, right? Like this thing to move forward, whereas the woman is this more, I mean, this is like pretty across culture and time. It seems like there are different ways of this manifesting, like in yin and yang in Chinese philosophy and mysticism. There's a similar, pretty much actually that is like that yin and yang are associated with male and female, and one is receptive and the other is active force, male obviously being the latter. And so I think that the tricky thing about this text is that she seems like, as much as she uses this essentialism, it's like she also then undoes it, you know? It's like, it's not like she's like, oh, women are just like this and men are like this, so the world is going, is, you know, this, it's not biological determinism, I think, in that sense. I find it more, but yeah, I don't, what do you think?
I was thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking, so she has a lot to say about that essential difference, but she also has so much to say about that ideology of separate spheres in the 19th century that she is so pissed about. So about domesticity.
Right. Related to the quote with which we started of the perpetually passing into one another. So I think it's like we might almost think of these as and I need to think more about this in this text, but I think we could think about these as Platonic forms in a way. She's a huge Platonist, and that comes through very clearly through direct reference, and also this form of idealism that she has of there being these like pure essences is very Platonic, I think. So she has manliness and womanliness or yeah, like these kind of like abstract forms. And those are these like pure things, these pure essences. And then they in different bodies, like a different flesh, different bodies, like absorb these different forms in always unique ways. And so like basically I think it's almost like what she says is like maybe men are more likely to do this. Women are like people who have this genitalia and that genitalia are like probably more likely to do these things, but society should, like, we need to get to the point where there is no social system that enforces somebody with this genitalia to do this and this genitalia to do this. And if we completely get rid of this, then there's going to be like a natural harmonious flow of like womanly men, some manly women, some womanly women, some manly men, and all of these things in between. That's do you think that's a fair reading?
Yes, I think it makes a lot of sense. But I do want to get back to the comments that she has on marriage, because that again, you know, kind of riffs against what you just talked about. So all that you said, I think, is there.
She has no imagination of same-sex marriage, for instance. And that, I mean, politically, she could absolutely never say that.
It's heteronormative and it has to be monogamous. And then she has this catalog of things where she says, of grades of equality that she observes in marriages, and she gives us case studies of those surrounding her, and maybe she pivots on Wollstonecraft's marriage, Mary Wollstonecraft's marriage. So she says that the first grade is household partnership. So men want their wives to do this and wives want their men to do this. Then she says the second grade is mutual idolatry. The third is intellectual companionship. And it's clear that there's a rising component here, more perfection of her visions of marriage. And the fourth is religious unions, as in pilgrimage towards the same shrine. And that's interesting because intellectual companionship is a pre-stage to that. And then that religious, again, we have the body, again, we have the spiritual pilgrimage towards the same shrine. That's the highest grade of equality that you can achieve in marriage. And that's what she wants for women. And so I like the grades, you know, I could deal with that. But she does not seem able to see woman beyond being married. So singlehood.
Very interesting is that she was single until almost the time she died. I mean, she was like, she was single until she was like 37, I think. And so that's the bizarre thing that I think, like, there's one thing, which is what she writes and what she publishes. And there's another thing of like, also, we need to also see, I'm not an expert by any means on 19th century gender politics. But I do think it's necessary to think that, like, she has an audience, right? And she has and so I'm not saying like that she doesn't mean what she's saying. And also like we can only really talk about the text that's here, and then to talk about the biography of Fuller's maybe another thing. But I don't know. I think we need to take all of that with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Yeah, but I can't believe you're pulling the author argument out of the hat here. I mean, on the one hand, it's great. I thought the same thing, but then again, she is a badass writer in the 19th century. She asserts her place.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say she was never married, or she was single for all of her life, but then she writes about marriage all the time? I mean, it's just like,
She also loved women, though. I mean, is it okay if I read a quick excerpt from a journal of hers? Yeah. So again, confusing stuff here. We're not going to get much more clarity. It's from 1842. So she falls in love with a woman named Anna Barker. And I mean, she had like huge, I don't know what to call them. And obviously this is the subject of great debate. She says here, I have so often thought over the intimacy between her and Madame de Stael. It is so true that a woman may be in love with a woman and a man with a man. It is so pleasant to be sure of it, because undoubtedly it is the same love that we shall feel when we are angels, when we ascend to the only place fit for the mignons, where sie fragen nicht nach Mann und Weib. Mm. It is regulated by this. So here it gets more complex. And again, this is like her thing. Like, she really seems disturbed by physical sexuality, whether manly or between, whether hetero or homosexual. But anyway, it is regulated by the same law as that of love between persons of different sexes. Only it is purely intellectual and spiritual, unprofaned by any mixture of lower instincts, undisturbed by any need of consulting temporal interests. Its law is the desire of the spirit to realize a whole, which makes it seek in another being for what it finds not in itself. But then later, she says, then again that night when she leaned on me and her eyes were such a deep blue, violet blue, so like night as they never were before, and we both felt such a strange mystic thrill and knew what we had never known before. I mean, that sounds like she's got a crush.
Oh, and maybe more than that. And it sounds like the action is just happening. So that seems to be, might I dare say, divorced from Woman in the 19th Century. That seems to be a different setting. So Woman in the 19th Century then, so she doesn't include any of these references, as best as I remember, in Woman in the 19th Century. So it seems that mm-hmm. the text is written for an audience and is directed not to scandalize people by burdening them with having to acknowledge, you know, homosexual love or going beyond the heterosexual norm.
Yeah.
And that's also maybe an explanation why she has to say so much about marriage. Because obviously that's the institution that people are going to talk to. And she addresses the criticisms of the women's liberation movement, saying, oh, if women don't take care of the children, then that will be the end of civilization. So if we give them the right to vote, then, you know, that means that we're over, we're done with. She does address these criticisms. And but she also says that the institution of marriage as it exists in her surroundings, in her day and age, is based on the fact that women have been infantilized by men, that they are not allowed to realize their potential. And she says, union is only possible to those who are units.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a super intriguing quote, because if you're not a unit, then you can't form a union with somebody else. So first, you have to become your own woman, and then you can form a union. And this would make the text more of a manifesto of a social commentary than a philosophical tract. There's something that maybe we can start wrapping this up a little bit. So
mm-hmm.
in the end, then, if this is a social commentary and she speaks to people and she speaks to women, we might want to discuss who she speaks to. So she says, in the end, so after, this is also a nice logic of the text where she has a long text and then she says, okay, now I've said all these things, I give you a little summary. So towards the end, the final pages are really a summary, a retracing of her own steps.
Right.
Which I was very grateful for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it allows you to kind of check your reading experience, saying, okay, did I read all this? Do I remember this argument, or is this just something that I did not catch? So she says, I don't speak to men. You need to teach and warn one another. That's what she says. I speak to American women, and I speak to young girls who are subject to the teachings of the woods. So she again goes back to this concept of the young girl is unschooled, unspoiled by too much education. And she says, the time is now. And what we have to do, and this is a key point for me in how she articulates the feminist project. So she doesn't say, like, for instance, Katie Stanton in the Declaration of Sentiments, that we have to overthrow this rule of the tyrant, because that's what the Declaration of Sentiments does. It's saying we have been misused by a tyrant. The tyrant is man, and we have to do away with it. They use the revolutionary gesture of the founding of the United States. That, you know, highly mythologized gesture. Fuller doesn't do that. She says, the time is now, but we have to use men to get the job done. Men have to be the head, and we have to be his hands.
Hmm.
So this is, you know, nothing of the later feminist manifestos, you know, like Valerie Solana's scum manifestos, you know, tear off, cut off all the dicks, get do away with the men. She says, we have to be smart. So we have to make men believe they're doing, they're the head of the architect of the feminist project while we're the hands. And that's what I really like about this ending, because she says, we do have power. And this is the ending where she talks about the almost happening annexation of Texas in 1845. So a few months after this is published, Texas is annexed by the United States, and the Eastern and Northeastern intellectuals, the Transcendentalists, saw this very critically because it meant that the slavery territory was aggrandized in the United States. So Texas became a slave state, and they said that's why we're against the annexation of Texas. But this has not happened as she publishes this. As she publishes this, she says, we have a responsibility to deal with this annexation of Texas and kind of try to prevent it. And she asked the women, have you nothing to do with this? You have a part in this as well. And she says, your power is moral power. And that's where we get back to the logic of how can we achieve this feminist project? Well, men can think that they're the heads, but we have to be the hands. That's the end. Cherish your best hopes as a faith and abide by them in action. That's how she ends. And then we have another nice poem of hers. Fear not thou to wind the horn. Persist to ask and it will come, the palace of king and queen. The palace home of king and queen. So she imagines the perfect celestial home of man and woman together as the goal of this feminist project in the end.
Yeah, I think an unfettered, harmonious flow of gender.
Yeah.
That kind of pass without like the corruption of what she sees as of social corruption.
Yeah.
But then it gets back to what your question is. It does seem essentialist then to say that there is this like underlying masculinity and femininity that just needs to be revealed, but also it's always dynamic and always changing, I think, over time, right? I think, because she always says now is a new age. It's a new era. She repeats that throughout. It seems like it's the time now for these gender energies to go to another level. And that's this kind of religious revolutionary aspect of it, that it's heading, that things, it's teleological, you know, it's heading in toward an upward level and kind of Hegelian in a way of like this sense of these two opposing things turning into some new, better thing, you know, this kind of dialectical, evolutionary theory.
Yeah. And above it, again, is her author persona. She says her vantage point. In the opening, she says, I have this feeling of, I read the signs in the newspapers, I read new views, and I think something's happening. If only I could see the situation not from a street level, but from the top of a house as a vantage point. So she wishes for more oversight or bird's eye perspective. And in the end, she says, I stand in the sunny noon of life. Objects no longer glitter in the dews of morning, neither are yet softened by the shadows of evening. This just reminded me of Dante's Inferno when he goes and he says, I'm in the middle of my life. Hmm. And I might be misquoting this, but he goes into this new situation in the midst of his life. Enough is left, even by experience, to point distinctly to the glories of that destiny. Faint, but not to be mistaken, streaks of the future day. And a little before, she says, I must beat my own pulse, true in the heart of the world.
Mm-hmm. And that echoes also, that kind of anticipates Thoreau's beat to the rhythm of one's own drum or to a different drum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of this, like, and that's this like singular, and that to me is what's so important to see, I think, with this text is that it is so, the way that it does transcendentalism so particularly in this feminist womanly mode, where like, yeah, I mean, you have like the individual being this kind of like conduit for this greater world spirit, universal spirit. Yeah. And of Emerson's, I am a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. Yeah. And
yes.
So wonderful here at the end. And so strange at the end in the same paragraph that you just quoted, where she says, I stand in the sunny noon of life, which is just a wonderful sentence. But then at the end of that paragraph, yet enough is left, even by experience, to point distinctly to the glories of that destiny. Faint, but not to be mistaken, streaks of the future day, I can say with the bard, though many have suffered shipwreck, still beat noble hearts. And I think part of the curious author figure of Margaret Fuller and her kind of precarious situation in American literature and in American and global feminism and political history is her just kind of very, as we talk about with the text too, I mean, it's very hard to approach and very complex and multi-layered. And I think also with her, this very curious story of at exactly 40 years old, dying, I think, what is it, 200 meters off the coast of Coney Island, New York City.
In
a shipwreck. And so we have this, I mean, it's just like, there's this, I think also her way of writing, the way that this text is, it feels like it's this cosmic event, right? And so I feel, and it's so much about fate too. And about letting fate, letting these energies work their own way out. So I think there's this kind of eerie aspect to some of her work, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe I'm not being a good critic, a good partial critic and saying that, but I think the text is doing this too. So that when we hear in 2021, though many have suffered shipwreck, still beat noble hearts. It's haunting in some ways, right?
Yeah. It's also mystical, and it goes beyond what we maybe understand as manifesto feminism or as other forms of feminist texts. So feminism as a movement is one thing, but the feminist texts that we read in seminars or in other settings are so different from this kind of text. Mm-hmm. So I'm very glad that we had a chance to explore some of the vistas and avenues that this text is taking. I mean, obviously you can take so many other turns. You can talk about Whitman, you can talk about the mesmerism, you can talk about so many other, we haven't touched, I wanted to talk about German romanticism and that kind of philosophy behind it, but time is running out. And I think it's a good way to close with this understanding of a woman in the noon of her life writing this text, being the only woman obviously able also to publish it in the US, and the mesmerizing, and I use this word attentively, mesmerizing experience it gives us as readers in the 21st century. So thank you, Andrew, for being my guest with this. I hope our listeners will turn to the text never to put it down. And this brings us to the end of episode 5 of Lady Fiction. Thank you for being my guest. And thank you also to you out there for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Steffi. Yep. And thanks for everyone for listening. I hope you all and enjoy this strange text and live with it in your own way.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the America Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.
And he's going to cut that out. Hopefully, it's not going to be a blooper or anything. Okay, so.